Hello and welcome back to Ecclesia Online. Hope that you had a great week this week. Glad that you are joining us on Facebook or YouTube or wherever you might be right now, or via recording or podcast. We are grateful to have you be a part of things, even if it is still from a distance. We are working on a plan for maybe next month, starting to get together in some way in person. I know that church that hosts us, that allows us to rent space, Court Street Methodist, sorry, we met at Court Street for like 10 years, Parkway Heights Methodist, was doing some upgrades and like signal strength and that kind of thing for their internet in the sanctuary, but we should be able to start doing a live stream from there and meeting in person in the coming weeks here, which we're very excited about, and we will let you know more about that. Assuming we've got enough people that want to show up, even if they're distance and kids are sitting with them. We would love to see you guys in person again on a week-to-week basis. I can't believe it's been as long as it has, and we miss seeing you guys a lot. I do also want to thank everyone for being okay with us just taking a week off last week. A lot of people were traveling. A lot of people were kind of out of town anyways, and it just felt like a good week just to kind of go radio silent and take a break from this. And so thank you for always being a congregation of people that are fine with that kind of decision, and we didn't catch any flack about or anything. Everyone was great. So glad to have you back. Missed you. Look forward to hopefully catching up with you on the Zoom call after this, if you guys can jump on with that. So we are still in Matthew. The lectionary texts have been walking through kind of the build up to the passion narrative, right? Jesus, as he comes back into Jerusalem, as he's heading towards the cross, and all the stories and parables and encounters he's having. And we're in Matthew 22 right now, and Matthew 22 we're in this portion of the text where Jesus has cleared the temple and made a lot of people mad, and then came back to the temple the next day and started teaching. And then he's having these encounters one after another with people who are challenging him, his authority. Who does he think he is? What is he trying to do? All these things. And so we're kind of in that vein still. And tonight's text is just such a good one. And it's one that I really, I don't know, I'm looking at it in some different lights in the last few years. And hopefully you will get a little something out of this. I'm sure you've heard the text before. There's a specific line from this teaching that is used a lot. Although I often think it's probably not used the way Jesus intended. So we're starting in verse 15 and going through, I think, verse 22. So we're in chapter 22 of Matthew, 15 through 22, if you want to follow along at home. But I will read you part of it now. We'll start talking about who the players are here and maybe what's really going on in this, what can be a little bit confusing passage. It says this: "Then the Pharisees went and plotted to entrap him in what he said. So they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, 'Teacher, we know that you are sincere and you teach the way of God in accordance with truth and show deference to no one, for you do not regard people with partiality.'" So let me stop right there for a second and kind of talk about who these different players are. So Jesus has been having these encounters with religious leaders and those who want to know who he is and where his authority comes from. And then here we have two groups mentioned that are coming together that, honestly, it's very strange that these two groups would be approaching Jesus together. It indicates that they found a common enemy, right? Because these are kind of strange bedfellows. And so you have the Pharisees and the Herodians. So let's talk about each of those groups real quick. One we know a lot more about than the other. The Pharisees we're pretty familiar with. We see them a lot in Scripture. We have a lot to kind of surrounding the Bible to kind of know about them and their history. This is going to be... it's not going to do it full justice, but the Pharisees are essentially kind of the religious purists. They are keepers of the law. They are keepers of the written law and the oral tradition that has been passed on for generations. And the underlying philosophy is that if we are as pure as we're intended to be religiously, if we do all the things we're supposed to do, if we're as set apart and chosen by God and we act like it, through this purity of practice, that's where freedom will come someday. That's where, you know, they will get their own nation back and God will restore them and all the things that they're waiting for a Messiah to come one day and do. For the Pharisees, kind of getting their religion right and making sure it's done purely and correctly is kind of the key to that. Now, these folks have learned how to work within the system, right? They're not struggling necessarily within the system of the oppressor that, you know, where Rome is there, but they do want Rome to go away, and they do think that God is calling them to act a certain way. And when they kind of, I guess, behave the way they're supposed to, eventually God will save them and they will be restored again. And then with them, you have this group called the Herodians. So like Herod, I-A-N-S, Herodians. And honestly, we have no idea who these people are. There's nothing else really to go off of who this group is. They're not really mentioned anyplace else. However, given that Herod is in their name, it's pretty safe to say that they must like Herod a lot, right? Who is the Roman representative that is controlling Jerusalem and kind of their present leader or oppressor, depending on which way you talked about it. But so they're pro-Herod, right? So you have the Pharisees that are religiously pure and that are waiting for the Messiah to overthrow Rome, and you have this group that is somehow pro-Herod, and we don't know much else. And then you have to ask yourself, why are these groups getting together? Why are these two groups of people coming together and approaching Jesus to try and trip him up, right? And then they begin with this whole saying that you get the sense is not authentic deference to Jesus, which is, you know, teacher, we know that you are sincere and teach the way of God and accords the truth and show no deference to anybody. You do not regard people with partiality. They're buttering them up on the front end. And you get the sense that this is not authentic right off the bat, right? This is kind of one of those things that Jesus would kind of know something was coming, right? As if Sarah started a sentence with me tonight as Michael, the wonderful husband who is never distracted and always does what he says he's going to do. I mean, if that's the way a sentence started in my house tonight, I would know I'm in trouble, right? That's probably not an authentic compliment. That's probably the setup for something. I'll keep my eyes out for what comes behind that, right? So this strange pairing show up, they show this kind of false deference to Jesus. These two people, again, together approaching Jesus with the question they're going to ask, we know right away that they're trying to trap Jesus, that they're trying to get him in trouble. And it says this next, and we'll explain why this is kind of a, in some ways, a smart way of trying to frame a question to get Jesus in trouble. Verse 17, tell us what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? Again, this is an obvious attempt to force Jesus to get in trouble, to give some kind of wrong answer, right? So if Jesus answers this question no, then he gets in trouble with one group of people. If he answers this question yes, then he gets in trouble with a whole nother group, right? Is it okay to pay taxes to the emperor? Now, if Jesus says no, don't pay taxes to the emperor in front of the Herodians who are friendly with the Roman authorities, well, now he's a traitor and he's rebellious and it's an act of sedition for him to do that, right? He can't do that. Like he's rebellious. This is the kind of Jewish radical that they're looking out for, right? So if he says no, then he's in trouble with the Herodians. But if he says yes, show deference to the emperor. Yes, give the emperor your money. Now, in front of the Pharisees and probably his own followers that he's teaching at the time, he looks like he's agreeing with or siding with or complicit with the oppressor, right? So this question is framed in such a way that no matter how you answer it, it creates heat and not light, right? So it's not a question asked in good faith. It's not a conversation they're really looking to have. It is framed in such a way to try and make him look bad no matter which way he turns, right? And so it's it's just the worst kind of conversation you can get into, right? It's half the conversations about politics or religion that you engage in on social media or around the table at Thanksgiving that you all want to avoid, because it's so often it's framed in such a way that you just, all it's ever going to do is produce heat, right? I think it's why we don't, we very rarely have authentic encounters and conversations about some very profoundly important things because we don't know how to do it. We don't know how to have a good faith conversation about them anymore. If you bring up a topic like abortion right now, I just said it out loud and a lot of you tensed up, right? Because what you know is the way those conversations are usually framed, it's no win. It's all about heat and not light, right? So if someone brings that up, if someone just says, so are you for or against abortion, right? That's a bad framing of that question. And it's, if you demonstrate it all, or if you say, you know, I have some, the heart-wrenching decision that must go in to ending a pregnancy and what all the factors are and all how deeply personal and horrible it is to have that conversation and think about doing that. Like, I just, it breaks my heart. And it's just weird for me to think about the government making that decision. And I don't want there to be any, but I don't know. I just don't think I want the government involved. Well, then you're a baby killer, right? And then if on the other side, if you say, well, you know, I think that life should be protected. And if that is life, then it has the same rights as anyone else. And I am concerned about the fact that there's a lot of abortions. And I feel like we may be ending life. Well, you know, then you hate women's health, if you want Handmaid's Tale to be nonfiction. And I honestly don't know anyone that fits in either of those camps, really, if they had honest conversations about this stuff. But when you get into politics and a lot of times religion, part of the trick that happens is people learn how to, and intentionally, I think, frame conversations and questions in such a way that it only produces heat and not light. And it's not in good faith. They're not trying to really engage Jesus on this. This is a zero-sum argument they're trying to make, right? And these kind of zero-sum arguments seek to basically eliminate the deeply difficult realities of living in an imperfect world, in this heartbreaking world that we live in, that is filled with difficult decisions and answers that are not easy if you can find them at all, right? And they're trying to do that with Jesus. This is a difficult world that the Jews live in. Right now, they are safe. Right now, they're not being attacked by their oppressor, but they're taxed heavily, and they're not treated fairly, and they're not able to do what they feel like God's calling them to do. And they're sure God wants them to have their own nation and all these things. They have these two realities, and navigating that is hard. Simple yes and no answers don't fit in that complicated of a world. But they're trying to box Jesus into this argument that is not in good faith. And Jesus just won't let them do it, right? He won't do the heat without the light. And so Jesus' response here is genuinely just brilliant, right? And he says this, verse 18. But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why are you putting me to the test, you hypocrites?" 19, show me the coin used for tax. And they brought him a denarius. Then he said to them, whose head is on this and whose title? They answered, the emperor's. All right, so this Jesus doesn't answer directly. He calls them hypocrites, and you'll kind of see why he calls them hypocrites here in a second. And then he asks them for the coin, the kind of coin you had to have in order to pay taxes. And this Roman coin, he asked them for this coin, and they produce it. And so he's doing something very rhetorically brilliant here that you may not pick up on if you don't really know the context here. Remember, they're on temple grounds. Jesus is doing this teaching on temple grounds. So they're in this very sacred Jewish place, right? They're on this sacred ground, and he asked them to produce this coin, and they do it. They got it in their pocket or satchel or whatever you have back in that day. They produce this coin. This coin has a graven image on it. It has an image of the emperor. And not only does it have an image, but it has an inscription that gives the emperor a status of deity, right? And so here they are walking in the temple, challenging Jesus and challenging his faithfulness and his religious practice. And they are carrying in the temple a graven image with an idolatrous saying on it. Okay. They're carrying this in the temple. And while they're trying to trap Jesus into this oversimplified, no-win, zero-sum test in front of everybody, Jesus has them voluntarily expose their own idolatry to everyone else. They reach in their pocket and they pull out an idol, right? So if this was some nice, easy answer A or B test that they were trying to, you know, put, you know, give to Jesus, if that was an easy test, they've already failed, right? And they're the ones giving the test. So Jesus doesn't answer their question, but he exposes their own hypocrisy and he exposes their own idolatry and how difficult it is even for them, the almighty them, right? Even for them to navigate this difficult world. Then he said to them, says this, verse 21. Then he said to them, give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's. And when they heard this, they were amazed. And they left him and went away. Right? So he answers, give to the emperor what is the emperor's? Whose image is on this? Whose inscription? The emperor's. Give to the emperor what is the emperor's? Give to God what is God's? And they are amazed and they walk away. Right? They walk away. Quiet, nothing else, no challenges. They walk away quiet and amazed. And I know it's really hard to imagine that this could actually happen, but here are people that disagree with Jesus, that are challenging him, that actually really heard what he said, were profoundly impacted by it, and walked away amazed. They're changed by it and to some degree, right? I know that never happens in any of our arguments. We just dig in and no one ever changes and no one's ever really listening to each other. They actually hear something. They walk away silent and amazed, right? And I want to hold on to that and think about what was so amazing about what Jesus said. I mean, it's a cool little saying, but it doesn't feel that profound to us, I don't think, to our modern ears. And one of the best commentaries I read on this text this week, one of the things it said was, and challenged the kind of the modern listener or reader to think about is, why aren't you as amazed as they were? Why aren't you as amazed as they were? And I think one of the reasons is because truthfully, I don't know if you've spent a lot of time studying this text or heard it preached before. Most of the time I've heard this text talk about, it's in a very kind of benign and toothless way, right? The render under God what is God, render Caesar what is Caesar's, that whole kind of thing that we hear talked about a lot. It's usually talked about as like this kind of instruction manual on how to be two things at once, right? Well, give to Caesar what's Caesar, give to God what's God's. Here's how you parcel out your life between God and the empire, right? Here's how here's how you divide yourself up so you can be in good standing in both places. Here's how you're a good citizen of this kingdom of the world you happen to find yourself in and a good citizen of the kingdom of God that we're supposed to be building in this world, right? Here's how you divide yourself up and parcel yourself out. But the empire gets taxes and political engagement and civic duty and patriotism, right? And then God gets church and religion and personal piety and all these kind of things. As if this kind of neat division of our lives is what Jesus is really saying here. That's not a very amazing thing to say. That's just what everyone was already doing. Right? As if Jesus is calling us to the kind of radical discipleship that gives God this, it gives this, and gives this over here, and this over there. Like, is that really what Jesus was talking about here? Is that what really amazed these Pharisees and Herodians? Why would that amaze them, right? They were already parceling their life out, as evidenced by the fact that they're in the temple having this conversation with their pockets filled with idols, right? Now, Pharisees were doing it in a different way than the Herodians were, and I'm sure there were different expectations and different ways of going about it. But they were all parceling themselves out. They must have known that Jesus was saying something bigger and more profound than, oh, just divide some of yourself here, divide some of yourself there. I don't think that's what Jesus was doing. I think they knew Christ was saying something bigger and more challenging to the way they were already living their lives, right? Christ is not trying to give them a safe way to straddle the fence. Christ is naming idolatry for what it is. I mean, them having that coin in their pocket is nothing really profoundly weird. I'm sure most of the people there had something in their pocket like that, right? But he calls attention to this thing that they're just taking for granted. This is just how we do things. And he's naming it as the idolatry that it is. And then he's instructing them to relieve themselves of all this idolatry. To give anything to someone other than God, that which belongs to God, is idolatry, right? That's what idolatry means. Earlier in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus lays this out very clearly. Now, he's talking about money specifically here, but the principle is the same, even though we're kind of talking about money with taxes here too. But Matthew 6:24 says, no one can serve two masters. We cannot divide ourselves. We cannot parcel ourselves out, right? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other, right? No one can serve two masters. I don't think Jesus is reversing course here. I don't think he gets to the temple and says, oh, no, that's fine. You can have two masters. Just give Caesar this and give God that. No, no. Discipleship is not about neatly dividing yourself out and having this tidy and beneficial way that you divide your life out into pieces and give it to different places. The life of discipleship is a life of rendering unto God what is God. And what is God's? According to Jesus, what we're giving to God is all of our heart, all of our soul, all of our mind, all of our strength, right? So what is God? The only thing that's God's is all of who you are, all of what you think, all of who and how you love, and all of what you do. Apart from that, feel free to give it to Caesar. Again, I don't think Jesus is trying to map out a way for us to divide our lives up. I think Jesus is trying to remind us of what truly belongs to God and what bears God's image. What bears God's image is us, all of us. We are made in the image of God. There is no part of who we truly are that belongs to anyone else or anything else. And to give any part of ourselves to that is an act of idolatry. Theologian Miroslav Volf, which is a great name. That name just makes him sound smarter than I'll ever sound. Miroslav Volf said this recently, and I really liked it. Quoting this passage, he says, give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's and to God the things that are God's. Therefore, he says, never give to the emperor the things that are God's. No glory, no ultimate trust, no full allegiance, no pledges of loyalty, and no promise of doing what one is told, right? In every endeavor, in all that we have but one ultimate allegiance, Christ, God, right? How I love, how I identify myself, how I vote, how I spend, how I act and react, all of it is God's. It's all God's. Everything else is an act of idolatry. And Jesus says, get rid of it. Let go of it. All are rendered, all of this is intended to be rendered to the one and only one who warrants it. The God who is love, right? So we don't, as disciples, we don't really get the option to portion out our lives to different things. That's not what discipleship is. Now we do it, but we're not supposed to be doing it. Just because we all do it doesn't mean it's okay, right? You say, yeah, but try not to portion any of yourself out. Try not to divide anything else out. Doesn't that make living in this world very difficult? Yes. Yes, it does. It's problematic. It's a problem that's hard to solve. In fact, Stanley Hauerwas, whose commentary I really liked this week, and he's the one that indicated, like, this should be shocking to us as well and should amaze us. He says this, and hopefully he uses a lot of the same words over and over again, but hopefully it makes sense as I read it out. He says, for many, this account of Jesus' claim that we are to give the emperor what is the emperor's and to God what is God's creates an insoluble problem. because they do not see how followers of Jesus can then live in the world as we know it. But to recognize that we have an insoluble problem is to begin to follow Jesus. Listen to that again. But to recognize that we have an insoluble problem is to begin to follow Jesus. Jesus' response to the Pharisees and Herodians does create an insoluble problem. But that is what it is meant to do. Here's that, this last line. It's maybe a little convoluted sounding, but I think it's a great line. You know you have a problem, at least if you're a disciple of Jesus, when you do not have a problem. You know you have a problem when you do not have a problem, right? When there's nothing inside of you during this presidential election that that feels conflicted as a Christian and someone who's got to vote for one of the people that's running, when there's nothing in you that's conflicted between the way our world is organized, the way this kingdom of the world works, and the kingdom of God that God is asking us to build, when that Venn diagram is one and the same, when there's nothing problematic about it, that's when you have a problem as a Christian. That's when you're delving into some idolatry someplace. You are giving to God something that is not God's. When it comes to living in one of the kingdoms of this world, even the best of the kingdoms of this world, if you are a disciple of Jesus, the biggest problem is when you have no tension. The biggest problem is when you don't have a problem. So I don't think this text is intended to make our lives easy. In fact, I think it's intended to make our lives more difficult. It's not intended to give us this simple little roadmap of how to be a good citizen here and a good citizen there. It's intended to call out the ways we have divided ourselves out and given unto Caesar, given unto others, that which only belongs to God. It's calling us back from that idolatry. We are to be resident aliens. We are to be out of place and peculiar and weird. We are supposed to be uncomfortable in this world because this world is not as it was intended to be. And it is not what it'll one day be again. So as we enter into this last couple weeks of craziness and politics and everything else, may we always remember what kingdom we belong to. And may we not divide out any part of ourselves and give it to anyone other than the one who created us. Give unto God what is God's, and it's all God's. All right, peace be with you. Jump on Zoom and catch up with us after this. We miss you guys. We look forward to seeing you in person sometime again soon. Peace be with you.